Welcome to Pacific Mammal Research's Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series, and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado, welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And this week was a marine, this is a marine mammal highlight, and it was between the Heavysides dolphin and the Fraser's dolphin. And contrary to last week's landslide, or last marine mammal highlights, landslide of a victory, this one squeaked out by one vote. So if you voted for Heaviside, it might have been your vote that put them over the top. So good job.
And if you didn't, don't worry, because that means that we will have the Fraser's dolphin back in our poll at some point.
Yes, exactly. Both very cool. But yes, the Heavysides won out this time. So this was an interesting one. They're kind of isolated in a way and far away. And it's, we know some stuff, we don't know some stuff, and some stuff is confusing. So they're a mixed bag of species, but very beautiful looking. So
they are gorgeous. Yeah.
So let's start off. Kat will do that with what they look like and kind of where they're at right now.
Yeah. So let's talk first about where these guys are found, because you mentioned that they are a little bit isolated. So Heavysides dolphins are pretty much only found in the coastal waters off the southwest coast of Africa. So we're talking from northern Namibia to basically the south of Cape Province. So this is like a range of about 2,000-ish kilometers. Like, it's really not a huge range. It's like 2,000 to 2,500 kilometers, I think, is their coastal range.
That's super interesting, because when I talk about their home range size, put a pin in that. That's interesting.
Okay. So, and I found a couple different things with that, where some people were saying their range is like 1,500 kilometers, and then other ones were saying it's like 2,000 to 2,500.
Well, so yeah, mine was like, they have small home ranges, 876 square kilometers to 1,990 square kilometers. And I'm like, that's small? I personally wouldn't put that as small, and especially not small if their range is 2,000 kilometers. It seems like
that's basically like they could go anywhere within their range.
Right. Like,
yeah. So, okay, this is where I think we're already getting into a little bit of where this is confusing, right? So this is the thing. So their range is limited to this 2,000 kilometer coastline area. While they're not considered necessarily rare within this, they're not evenly distributed within that range. So this is a thing, and this is probably where it's getting into, like, we don't really know what their actual home ranges are. Like, we know it's not over the entirety of their range necessarily, that they do seem to like specific spots within that. Mm-hmm. But how much do they range within that? Sounds like we don't really have a great handle on that.
We do have some new research.
Ooh.
That may shed some light on that. Still confusing, but
okay. All right. So basically, like, stay tuned for more on this. All right, yeah, as we get into detail.
Still, I'd say 876 square kilometers is not a small home range to me.
Well, I mean, really square kilometers are different than kilometers, though.
Yeah, but still, like,
yeah, I
mean, small home range, I'm saying, like, you know, 30, 40 kilometers.
True. Like, true. You know? Right.
So I guess right. It just depends on what you mean by small.
Yes, exactly. So within this slightly confusing range, the distribution of these animals is likely, at least to some degree, limited by currents, right? So they prefer temperate, cool waters. So I know that I found one reference that was saying that in Angola, for example, their range seems to be limited to the Benguela current, because that area has more of that temperate, cool water. And so this really seems to be one of the main drivers for where these guys are found. In general, they inhabit mostly the coastal waters, usually at depths of less than 100 meters. And they seem to prefer sandy shores exposed to swell, which I thought was a very specific thing to say.
Which, I mean, that goes to, like, fascinating. Why they're specifically in a certain spot, because it has to have that specific habitat.
Yeah. And again, if you're thinking about the waters around Southern Africa, sharks are a big threat in this area, right? So predation, also killer whales are in this area as well. So again, this might be, if you can see underneath you with that sandy shore, Maybe that's helpful. Not quite sure. I'm sure Cindy will get into this a little bit more, but just to kind of again put a pin in this, some studies indicate that they do seem to inhabit the same area year round. Migratory patterns are not super well known. There was one individual that was satellite tagged that traveled 158 kilometers north of where he was tagged. So, you know, that's kind of a one of the ones they're going off of, but I'm really curious to hear more about the new research that we have with their distribution and range. Mm-hmm. In terms of what they look like, these guys are fairly small as dolphins go. So they're about 5.5 to about 5'6" in length. They're, you know, about the size of a harbor porpoise, which I think is really interesting. Yeah.
Very similar. Dorsal fin also is a little.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. So they are about 5.5 feet. They weigh between about 130 to 155 pounds. So again, this is very similar size to a harbor porpoise. They are kind of a blunt head as well. So they don't have a big extended rostrum. So they actually kind of almost look more like a porpoise because they really don't have that elongated rostrum that we would expect with a dolphin species. Mm-hmm. They have rounded, what they call paddle-shaped flippers. And their dorsal fin is more, more triangular than a lot of other dolphin species. So a lot of dolphin species have that more curved, what we call falcate dorsal fin. This one is a little bit more triangular.
Again, more porpoise-like.
More, it definitely looks more like a porpoise, which is fascinating.
And I'm going to talk about vocalizations, also more porpoise-like.
Ooh, cool. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think these are like the hybrid between the two dolphin and porpoise species.
Yeah. it's so, and they are cephalorhynchus species, which is really interesting. So, or genus, I guess. So in terms of coloration, they are very striking in their coloration, very distinctive. So it's really hard, especially given where they live, to confuse these guys with really any other species in this area. So the head, dorsal fin, flippers, tail, and back portion of the back of the animal are all like a darker gray. The front part of the animal is a lighter gray with and has the nice dark eye patch around each eye. And the belly or the underside is white. And then there are also flashes of white on the flank right below the dorsal fin. And it was really interesting. I found a spot where they were talking about a white patch on the that extends between the pec fins on the chest of the animal. And in males, this white patch ends in a point. Well, in females, this white patch widens out to cover the mammary slits. So if you see the underside of the animal, you can actually tell if it's male or female by the coloration.
So that's very similar to orcas, where they have the different coloration patterns there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Really interesting. So yeah, if you're not watching this on YouTube, definitely go Google a picture of these guys because they are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And yeah, very, very distinctive coloration. Again, especially given their size and what else lives around here, it's really very unlikely that you would confuse this with anything else.
Yeah, I saw that too. They're like confused with not anybody else because
really nothing
except for baby orcas. They did say that because of that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Coloration, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that color can look black depending on, you know, what lighting you're seeing it in and like how far away you are. Mm-hmm. But again, given the size, I mean, I guess you might 5.5 feet. It might be people think dolls porpoise or baby orcas too up here. So I guess it's
heard people say, look at the orca and it's a porpoise. So
yeah,
like a harbor porpoise. So
yeah,
you know, if you're not in the know of dolphin and porpoise species, it could be
confusing.
Yeah.
But if you're in the southern areas of Africa, you're probably seeing a heavy-sized dolphin if it's about this size and it has this kind of black and white and gray coloration.
The white on the side that comes up, like the white comes up and it does this like curve up into the body. And to me, it looks like somebody, you know, you take putty and you're like pulling the putty out like this.
Oh, like silly putty kind of?
Yeah, like silly putty. Yeah, it looks like.
Oh, cool. That's fun.
Too. So it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a fun visual.
Just what I thought of. Yeah. I have lots of fun visuals in my brain that may or may not make sense to anybody else, but
that's what makes naming animals so fun.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So yeah, that's what I have for where they live and what they look like. Pretty clear cut with these guys.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like I said, they're clear cut is a good way to define what they look like too. It's very striking differences in coloration.
Clean lines.
There's no mottled color into this. It's like that's the next color. Very cool. Okay, so for diet, I have two things. The one thing that is consistent across all the things that I looked at is that they love Hank.
Oh, interesting.
So,
yeah, okay. Yeah.
So Hank is their go-to, but they eat kingfish, gobies, plus octopus and squid. Like they do. So they eat a lot of different things. I could not find the actual study this referenced, but one website had that in a study of 17 dolphins, they found a total of 4,928 different food items.
Oh my gosh.
Like,
among 17
lot.
Animals?
Yeah, from 17 animals.
Wow.
So, like I said, I couldn't find the actual paper, so you know, take that with a grain of salt, but hopefully, you know, it's a reputable website, so I'm assuming they're correct, but they maybe are more opportunistic than we think, but for the most part, everybody's just like, yeah, they love hake.
Okay.
A few other species, so that's their main thing. And they even think that their movements are likely related to the movements of hake.
Which would make sense, again, if they're small and they can't maintain a ton of body mass, they would need to be foraging a lot more frequently. So if they're, you know, their prey would be driving their movement and behavior, I would guess, a lot.
Kind of like porpoises. Another thing like porpoises that I'll talk about a little bit more in the new research particularly, but they do have narrowband high frequency vocalizations.
Mm-hmm.
So very similar again to porpoises, those high frequencies dolphin species have high frequency, but not in the same way that porpoises do. Like porpoises are basically pretty much exclusively narrowband high frequency. And these guys are kind of, again, they're kind of in the middle. And I'll leave that for the new research, but for the most part, when they're foraging, they're using that narrowband high frequency, likely to avoid predators like killer whales. Right? If they're talking as such a high pitch that the dolphins, the orcas can't hear them, that's much safer for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll leave again a pin in that to talk about it in the new research a little bit later. And what's interesting is the when we were talking about the home ranges, they said most alongshore movements were less than 88 kilometers, and this is through photo ID. So they actually used photo ID to do that study.
Cool.
Yeah. Generally the consensus is that they're in small groups of less than 10, usually pairs and trios are the most common. Again, very
like
similar
porpoises,
right? Often in tight groups, but these guys are intensely social.
Mm.
So that's a little bit different than what we know of for porpoises, right? We're still learning about their associations, but they're not like dolphins where it's larger groups and they're obviously hanging out. So they're intensely social, but then I have another study that says the association patterns are fission-fusion, like dolphin species, but have basically random mixing. So it's not non-random associations. So to me, I guess it doesn't have to be counter, you know, whatever, like usually highly social, I think of highly differentiated societies, right? Their relationships and their social with those individuals. But I suppose you can be social just with everybody, you know, random.
Yeah.
Even if it's random. You're just like, hey, you're cool. I like you. Let's hang out.
Yeah.
So interesting. I think we still don't really fully understand it. The range is limited, like you said, to those less than 100 meter depths. And that's, again, also fairly similar to harbor porpoises because they like to be in a bit more shallow area. But contrary to harbor porpoises and other porpoise species, these guys are very active and sometimes boisterous. I just love that. That was a quote from one of the
love that word
books. Yeah. Boisterous, known to bow ride and wake surf. So they're not shy around boats. They'll even do ride the waves of breaking waves that are close to shore. They are quick and agile, often zooming around vessels and repeatedly leaping out of the water.
So, oh, that'd be so cool to see.
I know, right? Especially their coloration. Oh my God.
Yeah, it'd be beautiful.
Just beautiful. So, so they're quick and agile, often zooming, but then another one says that the rounded appendages and chunky body indicate that they are not particularly fast swimmers. But then
which
I
guess
one that was fast swimmers. So
I guess if you're doing like little bursts of speed, that's different than like,
yeah,
you're going at speed for a long time, or like a Dahl's porpoise that can travel up to like 50 miles an hour, you know?
Right. Yeah. So, and that could be, I mean, if you think about oceanic dolphins that are very slender and, you know, they're hydrodynamic, right? And these guys are less so because of blood. but they can still move quickly when they want to. Kind of like manatees. Manatees are not known for their speed, but they can move pretty quickly when they want to for short movements. So their movements again are usually based on that, on their primary prey, which is hake, and then they rest in the near shore waters during the day and forage at night, mostly on hake. So again, also, I mean, porpoises eat all the time, but they generally have peaks in the evening and the nighttime for that as well. So my last thing for the behavior is that the genetics show, and this isn't necessarily behavior, but talking about the group, the population size, the genetics show that it's likely one population, but more research is needed. And this was from a 2002 study with a small sample size. And I'm going to put a pin in that because there's new research on that genetics that shows something that's not the same, right? And it's
thing.
So we're going to get more into that. So they think it's one population, but new stuff is happening, showing something different. So I'll leave you guessing for that. So my favorite section here is reproduction, because this is very confusing. Basically, most of the ones that I've looked at, they go, we have no idea. No idea. We have no information about the reproduction. There's one that said some calves are born in the southern summer, which makes sense. So November to January,
summer.
Southern hemisphere. That was in the Marine Mammals book, which is a very, very good and reliable source. But then this other, from the Whale and Dolphin Conservation, because it was actually hard to find some references for just these guys in general. Like, there's just not that much out there. But they said that they're sexually mature between 5 to 9, pregnant for 10 to 11 months, and give birth every 2 to 3 years. It's very specific. And everybody else is like, we have no idea. So I don't know who's right.
Interesting.
And there was no reference as to where they got that information from. So I couldn't check the source. So I tend to go with, we have no idea. But that's the 10 to 11 months and give birth every 2 to 3 years. That's pretty common across porpoise and dolphin species. Mm-hmm. And particularly dolphins for the longer interbirth interval.
The later at sexual maturity too, like that's more like other dolphin species, typically are more sexually mature later.
But they said, this is the only place that I found for life expectancy. And they said 20 to 23 years.
This is on the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society.
Did you have a life expectancy anywhere?
I did not.
Okay. So that's the only place I ever found anything. And so that is counterintuitive because that's half the life less than half the life of normal dolphin species. So if you have the late sexual maturity and the longer interbirth interval, but without that extra life expectancy, like you cut your life expectancy in half, but you keep you're going to have a real hard time keeping your population if anything happens to it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's going to be hard. You're just not going to have enough time to replace the population if you're in danger. So, So I thought that was very interesting. So I have no idea whether that information is correct or not. But the overall is like, we basically kind of really don't know. So
if anybody listening knows anything about heavy-sized dolphins or active research happening in this area of Africa on heavy-sides, let us know. Because I think we're very intrigued by what is actually going on with these guys.
And none of the new research has anything about reproduction. So
I mean, it's one of the hardest things to study in wild species. So like, I get it. But at the same time, it's interesting since they are coastal that they don't have more visual on tracking the animals.
That study did photo ID. So like, you would think they would at least know, like, hey, we tend to see the calves at this point in time, you know, which is where they have that for the southern summer. But, you know, it's interesting that there's no further information. Even from stranded individuals, maybe they just don't strand. I don't know. So reproduction is confusing. But I think we don't know a lot. I think that's probably the best way to go. But it would be very interesting if that is true. If they and they still have that, that's very, very interesting. And actually, that kind of links back to the menopause episode we just did with the orcas. Do you extend the life expectancy but keep the reproduction the same, or vice versa, as to whether menopause would evolve? So, if you're interested in female reproduction, go check out the menopause episode. But that's I'm going to leave you with that confusing end to reproduction that we just don't know. Very similar to much of the other things we have here. But with that, we will take a quick break and be back with the abundance estimates and threats and the intriguing new research. We'll be right back.
Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast, and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy.
All right, we're back. So let's talk about more heavy sides, threats and abundance, right?
Yes. Yeah. So let's talk about status.
What we know.
Which again, like the rest of this episode, it's kind of a mixed bag. So they are, heavy sides are listed by the IUCN as near threatened. So what this means is that they don't qualify for being critically endangered or vulnerable right now. Those are the other kind of bins that they can be grouped into. But they are close to qualifying or are likely to qualify for a threatened category in the near future. A lot of this comes from not having a good idea of their overall population numbers and knowing that they have a very limited range. So basically, because we don't know a lot, we're not quite sure how under threat they are. Your face tells me you have a question.
Yes, I do have a question. Because yes. So you looked up the current IUCN list. So yeah. What's interesting is I have a quote from the paper, from one of the papers I was reading, that's talking about the first abundance estimates, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. That was in 2020. And they said that the IUCN Red List Global Species Assessment was revised from data deficient to near threatened, partly due to remaining uncertainty regarding the overall population structure, abundance, and anthropogenic threats.
Yeah, so that's their current listing is near threatened.
Is near threatened, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just explaining like what that means. So near threatened basically is like, we know enough to know that they could be under threat, but we don't know enough to know if they actually are threatened. So we're going to place them in this kind of like hedging sort of, they could be threatened, and we want to make sure that they are ready to move into a truly threatened category if we know more.
Which but is right nice now, to we're not assess quite sure. That like, yeah, hey, we don't know enough, but we know enough to know that they could be in trouble.
Right. So, and I guess that's the difference with data deficient, which we've done many species on here that are data deficient. That is literally like, we don't know. We don't have a good enough idea of how many animals might be present worldwide to even have an idea whether they're threatened or not.
Well, I mean, we don't even know how quickly they reproduce, for gosh sakes.
Like, that, exactly. And that's, I think that's right. All of this that we're talking about, all of this uncertainty flows into making that categorization distinction, where it's like, okay, we know that because they have this very limited home range, if anything happened to them, they would immediately be under threat. Yeah. However, we don't know what level of threat they're actually under right now. So near threatened, they are listed as near threatened.
So do you have what they're classified in from South Africa specifically?
I do not.
Oh, okay. So because this was from that paper as well, because it was abundance.
Okay.
So I'm going to say it here since it makes sense. What's interesting is, so the IUCN is like, it's near threatened because of all these things. The conservation status in Africa, South Africa, was recently updated from data deficient to least concern within South Africa, as they appear to be locally abundant in the southern part of the range. So it's like, now you have this larger group saying, hey, we don't know enough, but then the one that's right there going, that's okay. So that could pose some issues, right?
Yeah. And that's where, again, when I said at the top that they're not considered rare in their range, right? They're not evenly distributed across their range, but they're not considered rare within their range. So again, it's a kind of a gray area with these guys. So again, we don't have overall population estimates. However, some abundance estimates from photo ID studies are available. So for example, a three-year study between Cape Town and Lamberts Bay, South Africa, estimated that 527 animals were using 20 kilometers of coastline over a six-week survey effort. 3,429 animals were using 150 kilometers of coastline around St. Helena Bay, which is again within this same study area, and that was over three summer seasons. And 6,345 animals were using the full 390 kilometer coastline from Table Bay to Lamberts Bay. And that was over the full 3 years. So basically over the course of 3 years, they found that like around 6,000 animals were using the entirety of that coastline.
Interesting. What do you know what paper that was?
I forget. It's in the overall sources that I had, but I forget exactly which paper.
Because I have one.
I think that was from the IUCN website.
Oh, interesting. Because yeah, I have the first abundance estimates in that with that one paper, and I don't know if I should say it now or in new research.
I'm just saying now.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about
so
it.
So these guys. So this Martin et al. 2020. These are the first abundance estimates for the species apparently. They used combined visual and acoustic double platform survey configuration to use to investigate factors affecting the detectability of heavisides and also duskies. And the average base annual baseline density and abundance estimates for heavisides in the NIMPA region, the marine protected area.
Namibia.
Namibia, thank you. Between 2012 and 2014 were 0.08 individuals per square kilometer and 1,594 individuals.
Right, but that's a different location.
Right.
So what I was just talking about is from South Africa.
Right.
So from Namibia, which is a different country, they're talking about the 1,000-ish, right?
Oh, see,
so that's what I'm saying. So they have these specific studies that are done in one part of their range. We're not talking about the entirety of the range here.
Interesting.
So this is a thing. So again, they're patchy within this overall distribution. They are kind of specific to these density patches, it seems like anyway. Right. So it sounds like in Namibia, we're talking around about, 1,000, 1,500 animals?
Yeah, about close to 1,600. Yeah, and they said, okay. And they also said relatively small population with a patchy distribution along the coastline, right? So very, consistent.
Right. And so in that South Africa area, again, using that 390 kilometers of coastline from Table Bay to Lamberts Bay, they found about 6,345 animals that had been over the 3 year study.
Right.
So again, this isn't talking about like, this is like overall number of animals, I think.
Yeah.
So again, it's a little confusing, right? Where it seems like they have these denser patches, but how many animals specifically are using these patches, we don't fully know. Right. But again, this is where it gets into confusing of saying, well, they're locally abundant. Well, that might be true, but if that's right. And if you're saying the local abundance is high, but the overall population range, that local abundance makes up 90% of their entire population.
Right.
That's a different picture. So again, this is where it gets a little bit like, yes, we're getting very granular here, but we don't fully know how each of these feeds into the overall population picture.
Yeah. And this one from confusing. And Namibia is the first abundance estimates for that area, and that was in 2020. So we don't have a lot of long term data on exactly is that high, is that low, is that average, what has it been? And I'd also like to put an asterisk here is that geography is not my thing, so I definitely do not know. Like you were saying those names, I'm like, I don't know where those are. And I think most of the studies that I did for the new research have all been in that area, that Namibia. Area. So that's why I was like, wait a minute, that's different than what I have. And like, oh, because you're talking about a different place. That makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And I think all of this, just before we get into the threats, all of this just really highlights that, yes, these guys are coastal, but also when we're talking about doing research in countries like Africa, there's a lot less funding and it can be a lot more challenging. And I'll get into this a little bit in the threats. There's a lot of this part of their range actually has very low population density on land. So there's not a ton of people that are observing these guys from land and throughout their range. So there's a lot of different factors that kind of go into why we don't know quite as much about these animals.
Yeah.
And it can be harder to conduct research, especially long-term funded research in these parts of the world because other things just take preference.
Yeah.
So with that being said, let's get into their threats. And it's not quite as bleak of a picture as for some species we do, which is awesome. Always love when I don't have a really depressing one. So again, like I just said, these guys are considered slightly less at risk than some other species because of that low population density of humans in their range and the lack of large ports along the coastline within their range. So there's less anthropogenic effects directly impacting them. However, there are still some. So let's get into it. Mm-hmm. Number one is entanglement. So again, as you might expect, given that these guys are coastal, their proximity to shore and smaller size does make them a lot more susceptible to entanglement in inshore fishing gear. So things like beach seines, purse seines, trawls, gill nets, etc.
Just like porpoises.
Exactly. So this is a huge issue for porpoises, especially in places like Europe, right? And the UK, where some of these larger trawl fisheries are very susceptible to bycatching porpoise. So again, because of that small size and where they're located and likely what they're feeding on, if there are hake fisheries in the area, they're going to interact with it with fishing gear. Mm-hmm. Although bycatching commercial fisheries does seem to be fairly low, there is specifically a midwater trawl fishery for horse mackerel, apparently operating off of South Africa's west coast. And that one was specifically noted as a fishery of concern. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they've had larger bycatch rates in that specific fishery, perhaps, but that is one they are watching, I think, to see how impactful that is on the species. Mm-hmm. In terms of active hunting, they are protected from commercial hunts. However, again, their proximity to the shore does make them vulnerable to being caught by harpoons or guns by human consumption. So the heavy-sized dolphins are protected within a 322-kilometer exclusive fishery zone, or EFZ, off the coast of South Africa and within a 20-kilometer EFZ off the coast of Namibia. So basically, you can't harm these animals in those protected areas. But again, this sounds like it's just more of a kind of an opportunistic, or perhaps even fishermen who are like, hey, you were taking my fish, get out of here, shooting at them, things like that. Another one which was interesting was construction and offshore mining. So the impacts of marine mining and notably sediment dredging for phosphates, the impacts on the marine environment aren't really that well understood, but this basically means direct destruction of the seabed and the benthic fauna. This also is potentially releasing hazardous materials into the ocean. And there are quite a few proposed onshore processing plants as well in Namibia, which are in or near known high use areas for heavy-sized dolphins, and specifically at a couple of different ports in that area where the dolphins are known to frequent. So this sounds like it's kind of an evolving threat. We're not quite sure how this might impact the animals, but it's likely to have a pretty big impact. And again, because there's less people presence, this would seem on the surface of it like a great place to do this because you're not disturbing people. Mm-hmm. But these animals are exclusively using this area. That's a big deal for them. We already talked a little bit about predation. So again, in this area, really their main threats are going to be from orcas and from shark species. Again, we don't have good numbers on how many animals per year are taken due to predation, but that is always a threat for them. And then the last one is climate change. So again, because of the limited temperature range that is occupied by these guys, and they seem to really prefer that Benguela, the Benguela current ecosystem, which is a cold water system, which is then surrounded by the warmer waters, right? So you have this colder water current flowing, and then you have the warmer tropical waters around it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They have heavy-sized dolphins have been identified as one of the cetacean species that are most at risk from large changes of global climate change because they are so closely associated. They're so closely associated with that. Yeah, exactly. So if that starts to go away or change, that could have massive impacts on, again, direct and indirect impacts, reducing foraging, increasing illness or susceptibility to illness, et cetera.
Yeah.
I do have a couple of fun facts, but I'll save those till the end. Because I'm impatient and I want to hear about the new research.
There is some cool stuff, right? So we already talked about one thing, so that's it reduces how much we got going through here. But this other stuff is actually pretty cool too. I wish there was more in reproduction, but alas, there's nothing. So we're gonna go back to vocalization. So remember that they have that narrowband high frequency, which is likely for to be cryptic, so that they can talk about foraging and finding food without announcing to the orcas where they are so for them to be there. So this is by Martin et al. 2018, and it's about acoustic relaxing of of the acoustic crypsis for increased communication. Yes. Ooh,
cool title.
I know, right? So the Hevesian dolphins they were thought to exclusively produce those narrowband frequencies, echolocation clicks, with a centroid, I always like that word, centroid, frequency around 125 kilohertz and little to no energy below 100. Like they just
wow, don't okay.
That. Yeah. But through this study, they demonstrated that the Hevesian dolphins produce a second type of click with lower frequency and broader bandwidth in a frequency range that is audible to killer whales.
Okay.
So it's most likely that the benefits of these clicks is to decrease transmission directivity, right? The narrowband high frequency is like, you can only hear it if you're right in front of it, right? If it's wider range, it can go a wider array.
Spread farther.
So more people can hear it, or more dolphins. And increase conspecific communication range. So you're increasing who you can talk to within that range. But the bad side is that the orcas can also hear you too. So the dual click strategy therefore allows these social dolphins to maintain acoustic crypsis during navigation and foraging, and to selectively relax their crypsis to facilitate communication with conspecifics.
That is super cool.
Isn't that neat?
It makes a lot of sense, right? Where like you'd have these different techniques and strategies depending on what your activity is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think awesome. Like this is very similar again to porpoises, where like they have these, but they're also social. So like we need to know more about the vocalizations, because we know that porpoises can, I think, go lower than what they were saying here for these guys. But it makes sense that you're going to have do things for different times and be able to relax that if needed to better communication. Because right? If you're yelling in one direction, nobody's hearing you. You're wasting your time talking to your friends. So I thought that was really, really super cool. Just showing that they can actually do that. So along that, Martin et al. 2019, following this paper, then published another paper, to buzz or burst pulse, the functional role of vocalizations. So they looked at the relationship between buzzing, so echolocation buzzing, the clicks for finding food, and then burst pulse signals. And burst pulse signals, just for a brief recap, are these weird things that's like a whistle and a click combined. And they're really hard to research and understand what the heck is going on, because they're just this weird hybrid. But burst pulses, I know from my dolphin work in the Bahamas, are very common in social communication. Like they use those a lot in that kind of communication thing. And so they looked at the relationship between the echolocation buzzing and the burst pulse signals in both surface behavior, foraging, interacting with the kayak and socializing, and group size. And they found that burst pulses were strongly linked to socializing behavior and occurred more often and more frequently during socializing and much less during foraging, which makes sense if, as we see with other dolphins, that's when they use them. Buzz vocalizations were not strongly linked to a specific behavior, although there was some evidence of an increase in production during foraging and socializing. So buzzing seems to be kind of all around thing, and burst pulses are more just for communication.
Got it.
And they had individual level production rates of buzzing during foraging, the individual level production rates of buzzes during foraging and socializing, and burst pulses during socializing decreased with increasing group size. So they basically talked less as their group size increased.
Which makes sense, right? It's kind of like that, you know, you'd have to direct your communication because there's just more noise in general.
True. Yeah. But I mean, it seems like they're talking less though.
Interesting. So as the group size increased, they're talking less.
Yeah, the production rates of buzzes decreased and burst pulses decreased.
Interesting.
So I guess maybe they don't have to, because
you're in proximity.
So you're just like, yeah, hey, I can see you. Then they need visual as well. So
yeah. Huh. Very curious. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
They found they had a temporally patterned burst pulse signals that occurred within a series of burst pulses and were directly linked to specific events such as aerial leaping, backflipping, tail slapping, and potential mating. So there's particular things. So again, it's communication, like, hey, I want to mate with you, or hey, I'm having fun, or, you know, whatever. There's a specific reason why they're using it. And so this leads to the fact that there's more complex communication system based on these pulse vocalizations than previously understood, and perhaps driven by the need to facilitate the social interactions of the species. So again, more social than, like I think we're going to find with porpoises, there's more socialness to them than previously understood.
So interesting.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
Huh. Cool.
I'm trying to figure which one I want to do. There's two I have left, and I think I'm going to do this one next because this one still is acoustic related. So Gridley et al. In 2020 used a toad passive acoustic monitoring to complement visual surveys. And so they, again, was in the Namibian Islands Marine Protected Area, that same place that all the other studies that I have here are from. And they did dedicated visual and acoustic line transect surveys. The acoustic methods provided data in offshore areas and during overnight periods where you couldn't do visuals or less easy. But they were imperfect and not suitable for the ecologically important shallow coastal areas.
Oh, too much noise.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, background
too
noise.
Much like background, like things popping off and whatever, and they couldn't do it. So it was very interesting that they demonstrated the utility of the passive acoustic monitoring in those surveys, but it shows that both the visual and acoustic methods are needed to actually collect thorough data throughout the range. Right? You can only visuals you could use both places, but acoustic you could only use really on the offshore. So I thought that was very interesting, taking into consideration the ecology of the area. Certain types of research are just not going to be as well suited for it.
Yeah, coastal's hard because you have those crashing waves and the waves heading up rocks, and there's a lot of background noise.
Yeah, so if you're using just that, then you're going to be like, oh, they're not really around in the near coastal, but like, yeah, they are.
Yeah.
So it's good to have that combination. Mm-hmm. So a good important reminder to that plays into what you can do. Research wise. So the last one I have is on back to that population size. So this is Gopal et al. 2019. This is genetics and geographic variation with mitochondrial DNA. So that's the stuff you get from your mom. So they did a 395 biopsy skin samples that were analyzed, collecting from free ranging heavy-sized dolphins in seven locations between Table Bay and Walvis Bay, Namibia. Between South Africa and Namibia. Yeah. They used multiple genetic markers, which is important. And a wide geographic coverage and reasonably large sample sizes. So this is where I was saying that first study that showed it was just one population had small sample sizes. This was, you know, almost 400 animals from a wide.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And including both South Africa and Namibia, which are the two places we were talking about before with the abundance estimates. So all of the analysis rejected the hypothesis that there was one homogeneous population. So that's basically like,
interesting.
That's not true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But as with these dolphins are, but revealed contrasting results in the genetic structuring of the potential smaller populations within that. So they're like, it's definitely not one, but not sure what it is underneath them. So
interesting.
What it suggested is that there are two populations, either two populations or a fine scale subdivision of with six kind of subpopulations.
Mm.
The microsatellite markers that they used were indicative of two widespread populations with measurable gene flow between them.
Okay.
So basically the overall thing of the study was that there appears to be two primary populations, a northern and a southern, but within each, there is some limited structure, unknown how much, and suggesting that the gene flow is not entirely ubiquitous between the sites. So again, those patchy distribution, there is some gene flow, how much gene flow between those and how much that leads it to be genetically different is still kind of unknown, except for a northern and southern sections. But I think
so. What I'm
genetics in between.
Right. So what I'm visualizing is like an hourglass shape where it's like you have the primary population up here in the north and the primary population in the south, but then you have this sort of like narrow area of mixing potentially that might still be happening. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think if we're just looking at the two populations, that's a good visual. Yeah.
Okay.
But they're still unsure. The other one was like, could have six subpopulations within it. So it could be this.
Right. So depending on how fine scale,
you know, yeah.
Yeah.
But you still have that one major hourglass thing in the middle where there definitely are those two populations. What in between those is, you know, different. And this would be interesting to look at from photo ID, you know, and the individuals, like how does that match up with the genetics? And there could be socially distinct groups rather than genetically distinct groups, you know?
Right.
So again, it goes to that one way of research is not the best way to look at something. It's good to look at multiples because genetics are just not going to show you social, and social is not going to show you genetics.
Yeah. And all of those things feed into one another in terms of distinguishing what is actually a population versus not.
Exactly. Because if you're socially, you know, restricted to the small thing, eventually over time, you may become genetically distinct from another group because you're not interacting with them as much.
Yeah.
And then
Wow.
what are
So
those?
interesting.
I know, right? So again, they are, I think it's a good one to end on because it's like we have some clarity along with more confusion.
They're very enigmatic. They're very
Yes,
enigmatic species.
they are. They are for sure.
Cool. All
So yeah,
right.
so that's the really cool but confusing species of Heaviside Sophon. So for our last few things, what are the fun? I know we're gonna get to the names because I'm excited. The names are, I tried to stay away from the names, but I did see one thing about it, so I'm gonna.
Okay, so the main thing I have to share about the names is really just where their name came from. So these guys were originally discovered off the coast of South Africa by Captain Havisside, Havisside. And so are sometimes known as that original intended name, which is Havisside's dolphins. So they were originally intended to be called Havisside's dolphins.
Feel so bad for
However,
Captain Havisside.
I do too. I know. I'm like, I kind of want to just call them Havisside's dolphins because this
Yeah.
poor dude who actually discovered them. Basically, a case of mistaken identity resulted in them being named after a different captain, Mr. John Heaviside, instead. So they got the captain names muddled up, and he got the clar he got the name, and the other guy didn't.
Yeah, and I mean, it sucks because their names are really close, so I can see
I
how this
know that's
is
yeah.
happening, but like.
You'd think because they're really close, once they realize it was the wrong
You
name, they
would
would have
like
just
fix
changed it
it.
back.
Right. Come
So
on, guys.
they are sometimes still known as Havisside's dolphins. I think it depends who you're talking to.
Yeah.
And then they have another couple of fun common names. So they are also known as springers, jumpers, or squid hounds. And we were trying to figure out, we had another animal that we did on Marine Mammal Highlights recently that was also known as squid hounds, and I can't remember which one it was.
It might have been another Cephalorhynchus.
I think it was. I'll have to go back and check.
Yeah,
Anyway, so that was
but yeah,
kind of a fun
they're
little common
also,
name. So,
which I find like they're squid hounds, but they like everybody's like they eat hate. Like
I
that's what they
know. And
eat.
that's where I
Squid
was
was not
curious
at the
about
top
that
of
one.
any lists.
Yeah, where I'm like, huh, that's very interesting that they weren't like, that wasn't one of their primary prey.
Maybe there was like one subpopulation that like that's what they eat and that's what they saw. Like who knows? Or maybe it was just one person that
Maybe,
did that and then
maybe.
that name stuck because they're like, yeah, squid hounds, and everybody's like, that's
One
cool.
porpoise.
Yeah.
Or one dolphin, rather. I keep calling dolphins porpoises.
Well, because these guys, I swear to God, these are like hybrids. These are like the missing link between dolphins and porpoises.
Yes, yeah, so those are the fun facts that I wanted to just pop out really quick because they're really fun.
Yeah, no, I saw that too. I was like, oh, poor Havisside.
I
He
know. Poor
was
Captain
making history.
Havisside.
Yeah, he was doing good things and got tossed to the side. But anyway, all right. So that's very cool. These guys are very interesting. I'm excited to see, a lot of the research really, sometimes when I do the new research, it's, 2015, 20, early, late 2000s. These were all like 2019, 2020. Like, so I think there is more
Yeah.
research being done on these guys. So they're super exciting to see what they find out. Because this does seem to be a very interesting species, with some confusing stuff. So I'm excited to learn more about them as more research is done. So with that, we will let you go. Next week will be a journal review or a discussion topic of choice. Again, if you have anything you want us to talk about, please let us know in our social medias or through our email. We'd love to talk about whatever you want to talk about. Otherwise, we'll find something for you guys for us to talk about. Also, don't forget to go to our website and check out our merch. This is our I'm gonna say this now. This is our 10-year anniversary this year, so October will
Whoop.
be 10 years old. So be on the lookout for our social media where we're gonna start promoting that, and we will eventually have some new merch that has special 10-year anniversary stuff going on. So
Yep,
be
which
sure to
is
check
only going to
that.
be probably available for a short period of time. That'll be
Correct.
a sort of
Limited
an
edition.
exclusive launch. Yeah,
Yes.
exactly. So.
That'll probably be closer to the fall, probably like September, October, for that. So keep an eye out. So we're really excited about that. And other than that, just spread the word and donate if you can. That's what all this any donations and merchandise sales always go to back to the research and providing things like this for you guys. So thank you all for the support, whether you're listening, sharing, or donating. It's all greatly appreciated. And with that, we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about the species we discuss, check out our blog. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's PACMAM.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.